Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Your hosts for today are Susan Franzen and Gina McAndrews. Welcome.
This is an exciting day. I received word from some breaking news that I was going to sleep on last night. I saw an announcement of a Zoom bombing at a meeting of the Black Iowa Democratic Caucus in an email from Dana Jones, editor of the Black Iowa News. The next morning, Al Womble called to ask if he could make an announcement about that plus another upcoming event. Wednesday was the first day we could schedule, which is today. However, Al hasn't been able to join us yet. And so Mike and I are covering until we're trying to get him called.
Oh, well, Gina, I do see that we do have some pre-recorded material we're going to play later in the program. We'll follow up on the Ames School District's Black Lives Matter Week of Action. So we're going to hear once again from Dr. Anthony Jones to ask him what response he got from students and their parents for the event. So let's hear that recording now.
From our observation and our feedback, for our first time of our district participating in something like this, I would say from my perspective, it went really well.
Were there any particular high points?
Most of the time, you know, for me, high points always come from when I hear from students or parents who are speaking on behalf of something or an experience their students had in the classroom. So, for instance, I received a text message from one of the parents who spoke about how, you know, this is the first time that their daughter was able to see themselves represented in the classroom materials. Being able to see Black people shining in their gifts and making a difference in the activities and the learning that they were doing in class. I also have received an email from a high school student who identify as actually as trans, because, you know, one of the guiding principles was trans-affirming. I heard directly from one of our students who identify that way and really was thankful that we included that into our lessons and actually offered an opportunity to help continue teaching the teachers how important it is to engage in those conversations in the classroom. So those are some, just to name a few, that I really appreciated, and it was encouraging for me this year.
Were there any things that were didn't go as well as you expected?
Not too much. Again, you know, no more. We have some community members and some parents who were still opposed to us having conversations about queer-affirming and trans-affirming. And then we also had some, you know, similar families and community members. And I think it was more confusion around the dismantling of the Western Nicholas family. And so we spent a lot of time explaining what that meant. And so it was a lot of teaching. We actually heard back from some principals, you know, after the families had originally decided to opt out. After hearing what the week was actually about, not based on assumption, but actually spending some time speaking to some of our principals, they actually changed their mind and decided to send their kids to school. And so, you know, the difficult part was like being able to share with community members who were opposed just the background of what Black Lives Matter in school because action meant. And, you know, I would say that was a difficult part about it.
Well, I was surprised when I read what you were trying to do. It seemed to me much broader than Black Lives Matter. It also, of course, stressed other minority groups, cultural and ethnic minority groups, but then you brought in other groups that might be discriminated against. Queer and trans groups. So do you think that combining all of these together was a strength or a weakness?
I actually think it was a strength because when people typically think of Black History Month, And of course, we focus on race, which is, you know, of course, Black History Month is about race. But we always forget, especially in terms of speaking about equity, that Black people have disabilities, that Black people also identify as LGBTQ or queer. You know, we have Black people who have dyslexia. We have Black people who are in talented and gifted programs. And so oftentimes, what Black Lives Matter has broadened our perspective and understanding of what we mean and what we have been taught about Black people. Again, you know, usually we only hear about slavery, or we only hear about, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Or Rosa Parks or George Washington Carver. But we don't know all of the intricate and important identities that someone who may identify by race also have with them, and which what we call intersectionality. And so we realize that, you know, people are not only oppressed or have had struggles integrating in the schools, not just by their race, but also by other areas and identities in their lives. And so I feel like it was a strength because it allowed us to drill down more into identities of our students and families who enter our buildings each day.
Did you see any differences in the way the students interacted, say, in the lunchroom or in more informal settings?
Based upon the feedback that we received from principals, just the interaction within the classrooms, and again, I've mentioned this many times in some of the interviews that I've had so far up to this point, is that our students engage with each other anyway in the cafeteria, in the hallway. They typically understand differences in terms of how they relate to one another in the cafeteria, in the social area. The issue has always been that when they enter into the classroom, the conversations about identity and learning more in depth about Black students and queer students, Black students who are queer, and different dynamics of family makeup are never included within the instructional environment, which to me it sends an unspoken message that Black people didn't add any value to the U.S. or to academics. And so our students have always done a really good job in engaging with each other amongst differences. The part is that we haven't done a good job of integrating that into the classroom.
I am very interested in this because I was involved at the time that schools were being asked to recognize that there was harassment of gay students in the halls and in many places. And it was, in that case, it was student-driven, and so the students actually were recording all the instances that they saw. And I wondered if there are instances of harassment in the halls for any of these groups, because obviously you have a big choice of groups you could call names. So is that gone completely from the halls?
Oh, absolutely not. Now, we always have instances where we have students who are being bullied based on how they identify. And one of the things I always say is, you know, when things happen in a hallway, those are results of things not happening in other places. So we have classrooms teaching students how to interact with each other, right? So we have that. We have homes who are also teaching values. We also have institutions in the community who are also teaching values. And so my beliefs have always been that these are outward signs that we're seeing from students who are not engaging and learning about the importance of differences. And, you know, I would say, you know, in terms of the numbers, I wouldn't have the exact numbers of times there have been offenses or bullying or harassment in the hallways, but I believe that all of those things are a result of a lack of educating students of how to respond to differences. So, until we start engaging in better conversations in our classrooms, in our institutions, such as our churches, and in our homes, and how to interact with those who are not like you, we're going to continue to have instances where students are being picked on and bullied in the hallway, or the playground, or walking home from school, or And those are some of the things they're trying to get in front of as educators.
Well, you mentioned that you'd had conversations with parents who objected to certain aspects of this. Do you think that those conversations will spill over into the way the students interact?
I actually believe that those parents who have opposed, especially publicly, for some reason, we still believe that our kids, they may see us, they may hear what we're singing, but they're actually watching how we act and interact when we're in our homes and when we're in our cars, when we're talking to our friends or family members. They are actually learning from those conversations. And so when they hear their parents say, I don't mind diversity in Ames, that's one of the reasons that we love being in Ames. There's so much diversity. But then, when they're in the privacy of their homes or when they're interacting with their friends and they hear their parents saying something counter to that, then students are picking that part up more than what parents are saying publicly. And I've always believed that, those things come out when students begin to interact with others. But when you think about it, when we go to our institutions, and I use the example of church specifically, when you go into churches, you're more likely going to go to church where people look like you. They're more likely going to think like you. They're going to more likely vote like you. So those behaviors and those interactions matter. And so when students go into a different place where there are differences, people vote different ways, people believe different things, they have different family makeup, then when one side is teaching an inferior or an erasing of a culture, then when they engage in an environment where there's so many differences and they haven't been taught how to interact with those differences in a respectful, welcoming way, then students aren't going to respond in that way of what they've been taught.
Do you think you might ever do this kind of an activity again?
Yes, we would love to continue with Black Lives Matter at School Week of Action. Again, our district has made a commitment to equity and access and inclusion for all of our students. And, I know it seemed like before last week people had a different understanding of what equity meant or means. And for some reason, equity and equality and diversity, it all gets rolled up into one. But equity, in its simplicity means providing for students what they need. And when you think in terms of what our academic data look like, specifically for our Black and our Hispanic or Latinx students, have a lot of work to do in terms of creating an environment where our Black and Brown students have a sense of belonging. And that's more than just a program, but that's how the adults are interacting with our students, how they're interacting with each other, how they're engaging in their classrooms around different topics. And I believe those things are also a part of equity. And so we're going to continue to push our staff to get more toward that commitment that we made, and we have it on our website. We put it on documents. We speak about it every time we're in the community. We have boasted about our involvement in critical consciousness with our staff around professional learning for the past 4 years. And so what Black Lives Matter at School Week of Action, it was a test for us to really see where we are in our critical consciousness learning. And, this is for students. It's not for adults to feel comfortable. We have to prepare, and I said before, we have to prepare our students to live in a global and democratic society. And sometimes that society is not going to look like the home that you were raised in.
Thank you, Dr. Jones. It's good to hear that you got such a positive response to the Black Lives Matter Week of Action in the Ames Community School District. The exciting day we're having here at the KHY studio continues.
And I think I'll share that with you because as smooth as I'm sure our engineer Mike Murphy was, we had a pre-recorded section that was supposed to come in a different place in our schedule because I couldn't come on and Al Walma couldn't come on. And I suspect we're being protected from Zoom bombing. But here we are. We got all the right things done. And so I can hear what Al's harrowing experience was on Sunday night. Hi, Al. What happened and what are you going to do about it?
Sunday was one of our normal meetings for the Iowa Democratic Black Caucus. We hold our meetings on the first and third Sunday of every month at 7 p.m. And on Sunday, we had our special guest speaker, Ohio Congresswoman Joyce Beatty, who's also the incoming chair for the Congressional Black Caucus. We started our meetings like we normally do. We, you know, opened with a prayer. I introduced Congresswoman Beatty. And then she said, you know what, today's a Sunday. We're going to make this like a family meeting. We're going to make this a family event. We're going to make it joyous. And, you know, that's when everything started. People started shouting profanities, started shouting racial slurs, started shouting death threats. And the Congresswoman, I must admit, was, you know, quite unflappable at one point in time where I was trying as best I could to either mute or remove those people, but they had hacked in. So, you know, no matter what I did, they were still there. And at one point she said, you know, I've been in Congress for a long time. And, you know, nothing like this is going to shock me or surprise me. Just constantly yelling, like I said, racial slurs, profanities, really disgusting and awful things. And we eventually then had to shut the meeting down and move on with the evening. But fortunately, we were able to gather some information and turn that over to authorities. So hopefully soon we might be able to find out who these individuals are.
Okay. Well, presumably they don't know about KHOI yet, so I guess we have our own problems. We had problems getting people in. So, but what is the event you wanted to announce for Friday? It is Friday, right?
I was just saying we're having a special event with Congresswoman Cindy Axne and Maxine Waters this Friday at 7 o'clock. You'll be able to see it live on Facebook. It's also going to feature a number of our Black legislative members from right here in the state of Iowa. So the Iowa Democratic Black Caucus is very happy to be able to put that together and finally get that released. And then we've also got some other special guests we've got planned for in the future with the Iowa Democratic Black Caucus. We just also want to make sure we take precautions, protect against future incidents like what happened on Sunday. Our Facebook page is called the Black Caucus of the Iowa Democratic Party.
Okay. We can hear the whole program without having to come in through Zoom. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for telling us that we're coming in. And I think now we need to go to our next guest. If you don't have anything else to tell us about, we'll talk to you another time. Thanks so much, Al.
All right. Thank you, Susan.
In case you just tuned in, this is KHOI Community Radio. And your hosts for today have been Gina McAndrews and Susan Franson, with lots of technical help from Mike Murphy. And our next guest is Betty Andrews to tell us about a front page story in the Des Moines Sunday Register in the Opinion Page about a bill that she's very concerned with. Welcome, Betty. Please introduce yourself. I think you have lots of news with your many organizations.
Good morning. Good morning, Gina. Good morning, Susan. How are you? Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here and just share for a few minutes about some of the things that are happening with in my camp. I didn't know, Susan, before I move in, if there was more to your introduction or did you want me to just
write it? But under the circumstances, I'll just turn it over to you.
Okay, that's fine. Well, everyone, good morning again. I'm Betty Andrews. I'm the president of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP. I'm also the executive director of an organization called I'll Make Me a World in Iowa. And I'm really happy to be here. I want to just start out because I do a number of things in the community, talking a little bit about the challenges that we're seeing in the legislature. And many of you may be aware there are a lot of things going on, the impeachment trial. There are things that are, you know, we just heard about the Zoom bombing and a number of other things that are happening with our lives. But it's important to pay attention to what's happening on Capitol Hill. And I know, you know, as I said, the impeachment trial is going on. So our federal politics absolutely matter. It's critical that we address issues of that nature. But also we need to think about what is happening on a local level. When I say local, I mean state and in your community. So in thinking about that, and, you know, in our bill watch for Capitol Hill, and I'm talking about at the Iowa Capitol, we are very concerned with a number of the bills that we are seeing coming out of the legislature. But one piece in particular has to do with the combination of the notion to they say back the blue, and then also the anti-racial profiling legislation that many were expecting because of the work of the focus group on criminal justice reform. So just kind of to take us back a little bit, the NAACP has been working for the opportunity to have an anti-racial profiling law in the state of Iowa. And the reason that we're working for that is because we understand that the number one, Iowa is our prison system, as I've said on this program many times before, is outrageously disproportionate when it comes to African Americans in the prison system. And we were looking at a way to address that. And why that matters, because sometimes people think, oh, well, if you do the crime, you serve the time, et cetera. And what why that matters is that Iowa, in our number three ranking, we used to rank number one, but we're now number three. We are about 11 times more likely to lock up an African-American than we are a white person. And that's really scary. And we started looking at why that was happening and how that was happening. And we backed that up to understanding the situation with traffic stops and stops by the police. Now, it is not anything unique to Iowa. However, in Iowa, these disparities play out much greater, with African-Americans being 4% of the population and over 25% of the prison population. So when we started walking this back through the system, we looked at everything from policing to the way rulings happen, to the way prosecutors charge defendants, et cetera, probation, parole, and all of that. And one of the areas which it was clear was the entry point into the system, and that had to do with police interaction. And we found that African Americans are exponentially more likely to be stopped by police, and that when they are stopped, they are much more likely to be searched. Those searches generally result in actually less, people would be surprised, than less than the white population. And the reason is because they do way more on African Americans. In understanding that, we wanted to address these stops and how they were stopping. And there was a thing that police use that kind of is a discretionary piece called pretextual stops, stops on pretext. So if there is, say, you know, if you switch a lane or you miss a lane, a lot of times police are there and they are stopped for that. I mean, they may stop a person for that reason. But the problem is sometimes they're likely to stop a black person for that reason and not a white person for that reason, as a pretext to continue on and look for other things with African Americans. Well, that we noticed that that was feeding the criminal justice system and feeding these disparities. So we took that on to address that. And so the NAACP has been fighting for probably 5 years to get anti-racial profiling legislation passed, and particularly dealing with these pretextual stops and unbiased policing passed in the Iowa legislature as well. We have worked with the governor and other officials, and this past year at the Iowa Summit, so in 2020 at the Iowa Summit on Justice and Disparities, which is an annual event that happens every October addressing criminal justice reform. At that event in 2020, the governor appointed a criminal justice working group. So it's the Focus Committee on Criminal Justice Reform. One of the reasons and one of the charges was to ensure that Iowa's criminal justice system was unbiased. So we dealt with issues of reentry, and then we dealt with issues of racial profiling. And the goal was to produce some recommendations for the governor for legislation. And we did that work. We spent a year addressing racial profiling through the lens of the community, through the lens of law enforcement, through the lens of a number of engaged active entities. And in addressing that, we came up with some solid recommendations for unbiased policing. Really strong work. Obviously, the NAACP would have loved to see them go even further, but as a group that worked from every angle and having a number of people involved, the recommendations were really good. And we had the expectation that we would go into the legislative session and have a bill based on these recommendations. And we did have a bill that was based on the recommendations. However, we also, that was combined with these quote unquote back the blue measures. And these are completely different things. You have one that's talking and really targeting the protesters of last summer when addressing racial injustice and the death of George Floyd, and how that was symbolic for the historic relationship that the police have had with the African American community, which is not good. Overall, there are definitely some high points, but there are some desperate low points. And so addressing that and a movement that put the spotlight on those injustices. And so with the protesters and some of the things that happened, there were measures in this back the blue legislation that we felt as the NAACP were extremely heavy-handed. When we think about just a few things that they are attempting to create a crime out of quote unquote harassing police. They're looking at doubling sentences that are already in place from 5 year sentence to 10 year sentences. And that's, you know, when you're talking about simply annoying the police, which is not the thing that we always want to strive to do, but we want to make sure that the penalties are just if there are going to be penalties. And so we are looking at addressing this bill to address the fact that, number one, these things should not be even remotely connected. And the fact that they are is what I call a poison pill for the good things that this bill could do. The bill does have a number of the components that we recommended for anti-racial profiling and unbiased policing. However, due to the challenges with that Back the Blue piece, we feel that it corrupts the entire bill. So we are seeking ways to address that. I know also that we've heard from a number of law enforcement representatives that have challenged with the bill as well, even from the standpoint of police community relationships. So I just wanted to say that, number one, we are opposed to that legislation. I believe it's Senate file or it's Senate study bill 1140. We feel that it is a double-edged sword. It's trying to do too much. It is, unfortunately, a spoke in the wheel for an opportunity that Iowa has to make progress. So that is the one thing. Before I go, Susan, it looks like you have another guest, but before I go, I do want to make sure that if I put on my other hat and announce that we are excited and just switching, because this is Black History Month, and I want to make sure that we step into that just briefly. As the executive director of Iowa's African American Festival, I wanted to announce that Iowa's Iowa Make Me a World in Iowa is happening on February 26th for students across Iowa and February 27th for the general community. It is being done and conducted virtually. We are excited. We're going to have pretty much all the things that we have in our live event, but we are going to have them virtually. Our headliner is Christian Keys, who many might know from the show Saints and Sinners. He's also a brilliant entrepreneur, actor, film producer. And so we're excited to have him. We will also have an African storytelling troupe from New York City called Your Queens. And we will have a number of Iowa performances. We will have workshops on various topics, tracing your roots, the other strong lifestyle topics, social justice, of course, our African-American politics, politicians, and so on. And it's going to be a great time. We're so proud to have the support of our sponsors, including the Department of Cultural Affairs, Wells Fargo, and a number of others that are joining us. And we're just pleased to be able to present this. The website for the program for Iowa Make Me a World in Iowa, Iowa's African American Festival, is worldiniowa.org, worldiniowa.org. So this is a way, you know, it's Black History Month here in February, and we know that African American history happens not just in Black History Month, but while we're in Black History Month, this is going to be a great opportunity to make sure that you come by and take a look. So it's virtual. You can take a look live and in your living room. And so we look forward to any of you that can join us, worldiniowa.org. You have to register to participate, but worldiniowa.org is our website. Thank you so much, Susan.
Well, thank you, Betty. And we'll be talking about that bill probably with our legislative reporter, Laura Bellin, in some future program.
Sounds good.
Like there's a lot to unpack there. Thank you very much for being with us today, Betty.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, this is KHOI Community Radio with host Gina McAndrews and Susan Franzen, bringing you a program that features stories from a variety of Black history events. We started off with a follow-up to last week's program about Black Lives Matter Action Week in the Ames Public Schools. And you heard from Dr. Anthony Jones about the success of that program from his perspective, what he had heard, feedback that he had heard. And then you heard from Al Womble about the very disruptive event that they had earlier this week. and from Betty Andrews about some legislation we need to watch. And our next speaker is also for Black History Month. She has, well, I've really been looking forward to introducing Rachel Chase, whose book, Creating the Black Utopia of Buxton, Iowa. Many of you may be familiar with Buxton from various ways. And hello, Rachel.
Hello, Susan. Thanks for having me here.
Well, I'm so glad you could be here. So how did you happen to discover Buxton? You're not from Iowa.
I'm not from Iowa. And for those who, you know, I'm sure most people know, but those people who don't, Buxton was a coal mining town that was established in 1900 by the Consolidation Coal Company, which was owned by the Chicago Northwestern Railroad. And it is pretty well known for being a very different coal mining town, both the town itself, but it's most renowned for the people. The fact that 40 to 55% of the population was African American for most of its existence, and that it was a thriving community. Blacks were treated equal. There was pretty much overall not much segregation. People did live like in Swedetown separate, but that was kind of by choice. It wasn't forced at all. But they were leaders in the community. African Americans were doctors, lawyers, dentists, pharmacists, justices of the peace, etc. So I, as you mentioned, did not live in Iowa. I was writing romance, and my romance writing instructor, who became a friend over the years, she lived here in Ottumwa. And she said, you know, next time you visit, we have to take you to what's left of this amazing town. And so she and her husband took me to Buxton, what's left, and we walked through the cornfields to get there. And I just couldn't believe that such a town existed here in Iowa. And as I would visit her, I would just keep going to the State Historical Society, and I would research and research. I would listen to these interviews that were done of the former residents that lived there. And the more I uncovered, the more amazed I was, and the more, you know, I couldn't believe this existed. So I had no idea what I was going to do with this research, because I was, again, writing romance. And then in 2014, I thought, well, you know what? I've done all this research. I don't know if I want to continue writing romance. I'm going to move to Iowa, and I want to go ahead and write a book on it. So Lost Buxton was then born, and that came out in 2017. And then Creating the Black Utopia of Buxton, Iowa came out in 2019.
I've done quite a bit of research also on Buxton because of radio programs. There were some questions that I kept asking, and nobody seemed to really know the answers. And of course, the main one is who had the idea to create this kind of town. It was unique, but how did it happen? And I did find it had to do with Ben Buxton, but who he was and why he might have done this and what happened to him, I knew nothing about it. And then, of course, your book came and it answered all those questions. And a lot of individual, you have, but now, why don't you describe the difference between Lost Buxton and Creating the Black Utopia?
Lost Buxton is a pictorial history of Buxton. So I managed to find, I almost didn't think it was going to happen because I didn't know if I'd have enough images. It was hard to find them. The State Historical Society had a lot of images. And then I happened upon private collectors that had been collecting postcards, namely John Jacobs, who is a historian in Oskaloosa. He had, I want to say, 50 or more postcards of Buxton and newspaper articles and such. So the point is, it became mainly pictures with, I put captions that were quotes from different people that lived there, newspaper articles, etc., underneath the photos, because in a lot of those photos, you may not know who the people are. So I thought, well, you know, let's put quotes under there that kind of tell a story of what this picture represents. So as I was doing that, I realized, oh my gosh, but this just kind of, you know, whet my appetite for this story. And I was reading Dorothy Schweder's work and David Gradwall's work. and I was looking at, you know, the details around this, I wanted to know some of the more of the start to finish story, more of the Dorothy Schweder had mentioned welfare capitalism, but it was like a one liner in there. And I wanted to research and find out more about this. So the point I'm making is I just wanted to do more. And so I'd started researching some of the stuff in when I did Lost Buxton. I couldn't use it in that book. So I thought, okay, there's material here for another book. So that's when I did additional research and wrote Creating the Black Utopia of Buxton, Iowa.
Well, that's a great story. And that answers a question that I already had, because I knew Dorothy and David pretty well. And we'd even talked about going down and doing a field trip to the Buxton site. And I noticed that on your website, now, this is a show where we keep talking about websites and Facebook pages, but on your website, what is your website again?
Well, I have a few. I have RochelleChase.com, which is more of me and, you know, some of the background and some of the other articles and such that are about Buxton and as it relates to things I've done. Then there's LostBuxton.com, which is the site that sporadically, I need to do more, but as I come up with new things to write about, I put that information on lostbuxton.com. And so what you might be referring to, there was a gentleman there that had you know, himself gone to the site and also had used my book and David Gradwell's books and others and had tried to kind of figure out where different things were located. So I do have that on the site. And again, I have some, you know, people I discovered, like there was a woman author, Margaret Coleman. I have a little bit on Hattie Hutchinson, which was the first African-American woman to get a degree in a pharmacy degree. She lived in Buxton. Buxton had a pharmacy with her husband. And then there's just some other ones there. So I just try, again, when I have time, to write something and put them on that site.
Yeah, well, what impressed me was the little tour. Someone had done a virtual tour. So you see somebody motioning you down a path in Buxton.
Yeah.
So you can actually see what it looks like right now.
Yeah. Well, if you liked that, you'll like, I am launching a nonprofit, unitingthroughhistory.org, that's launching today. And one of the projects I'm working on with them is partnering with the University of Northern Iowa on a Main Street 360 project, which will allow for this digital experience or this 3D experience using old photographs of walking through Buxton and kind of seeing what that looked like. So that's a project that we will be, you know, raising funds for and working on, you know, to create that unique experience of Buxton.
Well, there's one other thing I'd like to, I guess, advertise, let our listeners know. If you have a book club and you'd like to read Lost Buxton or Creating the Black Utopia of Buxton, Iowa, you can order, I think, is that five books?
Yeah, five books.
Mm-hmm. And then you can invite Rochelle Chase to your book club. Now, how do you come to their book club?
Well, right now it's all been virtual via Zoom right now. I was doing a few in person, you know, I was doing a lot of traveling and speaking. And since I can't, they're all virtual right now due to COVID.
But you can. You can have your book club and have your computers on and see Rachel. And a lot of book clubs are virtual now, you know.
Yep, exactly. Exactly.
So this is really, would be really fun, I would think.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that.
Well, there's really a lot going on in your book life. And I guess that romance readers will now be watching for your name, Rochelle Chase, on in their apartment when they go to the bookstore.
Well, I'm not writing any more romance. I am working on another Buxton project, but no romance right now.
I guess that reality overtakes fiction.
Exactly. But we are starting a history book club with Uniting Through History. That'll be starting unitingthroughhistory.org. That's starting on March 1st. And then there's going to be a Buxton contest for middle school and high school students. They will be able to creatively tell the history of Buxton using this excerpt, and there will be a panel of judges, celebrity judges, and the final winners in each category, middle school and high school, get $1,500 for towards college, $500 cash, and then there's a second and third place prize for $500 and $250. So this is trying, it's called the Hip History Contest. It's trying to show young people that history can be fun, but also using it to tell the story, to educate in some creative, entertaining way the history of Buxton.
And a little postscript, I have learned of at least two pretty well-known people who had grandparents who lived in Buxton.
Mm-hmm.
One is Simon Estes, who we know here in Ames. He's nationally and world known, but he was at the Iowa State Faculty for a while and often sings in our band concert, sing in our band concerts. Wow. And the other one is Cory Booker.
Yeah.
And he also had ancestors in Buxton.
Yeah.
And maybe you could find out who else had ancestors in Buxton, because it was a great launching pad for people who were successful and went on to be successful.
Yeah. Well, I did have the privilege of meeting also the woman that was in the documentary that PBS did on Buxton with Simon Estes as the narrator, Miss Catherine Beverly. I did get a chance to meet her before she passed. She just passed not this year. I think it was last year or the year before at 105. And so she still had some memories about Buxton. I'm hoping to be able to put something together, article on her as well. So, yeah, there I'm finding, you know, people that attend my presentations. There's a lot of people that are saying, oh, my grandmother, my grandfather, a lot of Buxton connections here in Iowa.
Yes, and when David and Dorothy did their work, of course, there were a lot more people in Des Moines in the Buxton Club who were still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so they... we'll have to get them on KHOI and they can talk about the people that they knew.
Yeah, and there is a Remembering Buxton Club that did start as a result of one of the presentations I did in Des Moines. They're not meeting right now because of COVID, but they meet at the Des Moines Library in Forest Avenue, Des Moines Public Library. And it is people that were descendants, like the Colliers, who you would recognize from Dorothy Schweder's book and David Gradwell's book, Dorothy Collier. I think it was Dorothy. Gosh, I'm drawing a blank. But her daughter and granddaughter are also members of that club. So the point is there's lots of descendants that are members that are trying to keep the memories of Buxton alive.
Thank you so much for doing what you can do, have done, to keep the memory of Buxton alive.
Thank you. Thank you. And thanks for having me.
It's been a real pleasure. And I guess it's that time. This is KHOI Community Radio, Story City, Ames, and the surrounding area. And your hosts for today have been Gina McAndrews and I, Susan Franzen. Other voices you heard were Al Womble, Betty Andrews, Anthony Jones, and Rochelle Chase.
Remember that you can also hear local talk online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI provides a platform for citizen and public officials to air opinions and information. The views of our guests do not necessarily reflect those of KHOI. KHOI is a community, nonprofit, nonpartisan media. This program will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m.
Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. 2878. Or you can contact us through our website at khoifm.org. That's also all you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member, or you can renew your membership today. On the website, just hit the yellow Donate Become a Member button. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.